Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. More ballots will be counted in the Republican primary in Arizona's 5th congressional district. That's the race that Andy Biggs won over Christine Jones by just 9 votes. KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins has been covering the story, and he joins me. So, Jimmy, a judge issued a ruling today. More ballots will be counted. What did the judge say?
In today's ruling, a judge said that 18 ballots that were rejected because the people that cast those ballots, they cast them at the wrong precinct. The poll workers at that precinct told them their ballots would count if they cast a provisional ballot. That was incorrect. In the state of Arizona, if you cast a ballot in the wrong precinct, it in fact does not count. So the judge has said that that was inappropriate and that those 18 ballots in this Republican primary are in fact going to count.
Now, we obviously don't know for whom these voters cast their ballots. It could be Andy Biggs. It could be Christine Jones. It could be one of the other two candidates as well. So obviously we don't know how this is going to play out, but this was a race decided by only 9 votes. So twice that, 18 ballots, could potentially make a difference.
That's right. We do have some idea because in court yesterday at a preliminary injunction hearing, Christine Jones' campaign as well as Andy Biggs' campaign both called witnesses. And so from that, we can kind of infer that, and because of the testimony that they gave, many of them actually told the court who they voted for. So it looks like at least 7 or 8 of these ballots were from witnesses that were brought by the Jones campaign. But yes, we still don't know which way this could go. We probably won't know until this weekend. The recorder's office told me that they could potentially start posting the results as they're going through the ballots this weekend, but we will definitely know by Monday.
And this process has pushed back when the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors is set to certify the results, which has to happen before the Secretary of State can certify the results, which would trigger potentially a recount. When is the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors now set to do this? Because it was supposed to be today.
That's right. But in the judge's ruling, he said that the recorder's office cannot certify these results until these 18 additional ballots are counted. And so this has postponed things until Monday. So again, the recorder's office told me that they're going to go to the supervisors on Monday for the canvass. They will then certify their vote tallies to the Secretary of State that morning or afternoon.
Now, once the certification happens, we are likely headed to a recount, yes?
Yeah, that's right. We're at a 9-vote difference right now. But, you know, if Biggs and Jones split these votes, we're still going to be in a threshold that would automatically trigger a recount. And unfortunately, that will be the next task that the recorder's office is going to have to take on, you know, right away.
That's KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins. Thanks, Jimmy.
My pleasure, Mark.
The last time Arizona voted for a Democrat for president was 2 decades ago to re-elect Bill Clinton. To find another example, you have to go back to 1948. But the Hillary Clinton campaign has started investing in the state. KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block reports on whether Arizona is in play.
For months now, volunteers have been going door-to-door talking to Democrats and independents all over Arizona.
And are you going to be voting for Hillary Clinton?
We're in the small city of Prescott, on a street with towering pine trees. One voter who answers the door is Dawn Kleckner, an independent. She says many people in this area are conservative gun owners, and it's not so easy to identify as a Democrat.
I have people in my office saying, what are you registered as? And when you say independent, they're a lot more nice. But if you say, I've heard other people say Democrat, and they give them a stern stare.
Nevertheless, Democrats are making a hard push all over this state, even here in Yavapai County, where they have long been a quiet minority. Carrie Hull is the field organizer for the area.
I make the joke of, you know, having Democrats come out from under the rocks. It's time. Like, it's let's go. You know, let's all come together.
Hull is one of 160 paid Arizona Democratic Party staffers on the ground in the state. It's the biggest field operation Arizona Democrats have had, helped out by money from the National Party. This month, Clinton started airing TV ads here, which raises the question, is Arizona a swing state this year?
It's super exciting because everybody's talking about Arizona, Arizona. So it's like, wow, there is hope for change.
Democrats are encouraged by a growing Latino vote here that opposes Donald Trump and polls suggesting a much tighter race than in years past. Ballot initiatives to legalize marijuana and raise the minimum wage could also boost Democratic turnout. Statewide, Republicans outnumber Democrats 35% to 30%. But most of the rest of the state, over a third of all voters, are independents.
Arizona has been one of these states that National Democrats look at investing in and never actually quite get around to it. What's big difference this year is the Clinton campaign has actually put money down.
Andy Barr is a Democratic campaign consultant who's not working on the presidential race. He says Arizona isn't a key state for a Clinton victory, but it does present a promising opportunity for Democrats.
Donald Trump is performing so poorly in so many traditional swing states that it's freed up a lot of resources for other places.
By the same token, Barr says the Clinton campaign is likely to pull out of Arizona if her lead narrows in more important swing states. But Barr says there's a good reason for her to spend here. Arizona has a competitive Senate race, with Democrat Ann Kirkpatrick challenging John McCain. Meanwhile, Democrats aren't the only ones trying to get out the vote.
Hi, my name is Diana. I'm a volunteer with the Arizona Republican Party. How are you this evening?
At Republican state headquarters in Phoenix, volunteers are phone banking, but so far just once a week, and with fewer campaign field offices and paid staff compared to the Democrats. Arizona Republican Party spokesman Tim Seifert was unfazed to hear about that discrepancy.
The Democrats have done so poorly in Arizona over the last 10 years. It's only natural that they would try to do something a little different. And they're really going to have to step it up quite a bit.
Seifert says Democrats may have more money for the ground game, but Republicans have more registered voters and volunteers. Still, he acknowledges elections can be unpredictable, and Republicans here are taking nothing for granted. Jude Joffe Block, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
1 week ago on the show, we reported on a new national poll released by Latino Decisions and America's Voice. It focused on how Latinos across the country felt about presidential nominees Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, and asked respondents what issues they thought needed to be tackled by Congress. Today, the organizations unveiled state-specific results. Lynn Tremonti, Deputy Director of America's Voice, joins me to talk about what Arizona Latinos had to say. Lynn, the Latinos who were polled in Arizona favor Clinton 70-18, but Ann Kirkpatrick has a relatively small advantage over John McCain in that Senate race, 57-31. How unique is McCain?
McCain has the biggest profile on immigration out of any Republican currently running for office. He was very, as you know, I don't need to tell you this, very public in pushing for comprehensive immigration reform and, you know, really took a lot of hits. But I think that, you know, what was also public was his backtracking, his Secure the Border First. Now he opposes DACA and DAPA, which means that if his party is elected to the presidency, he would be totally fine with them taking away work permits from young people who got them through the 2012 DACA program. So, you know, he has a very mixed record, but he did early on really stick his neck out, and I think people know that. I also think for Kirkpatrick, not everybody knows her, right? She's not a household name the way John McCain is.
And the favorable, unfavorable numbers between McCain and Kirkpatrick are intriguing. Their favorable numbers are quite similar in the mid-40s, but McCain's unfavorables are much higher than Kirkpatrick's, and that in turn would lead to Latinos in the poll voting for Kirkpatrick.
Yeah, and I think Arizona's unusual compared to some of the other states in that regard, that even though some people have a good opinion of John McCain, that they're not going to vote for him. In some of the other states that we polled, you know, a strong opinion for, say, Rob Portman in Ohio is translating into stronger support for him than, for example, what Donald Trump is getting. So John McCain, as always, is a little bit unusual in this survey, and that's reflected in the results.
And what do these results say to you about the significance of DAPA and DACA to how Latinos may vote this November?
Right. Well, there is a question part where we ask, do you know where the candidates stand on those issues? And then we ask later on whether we give them their positions and we say, will make you more or less likely to support either candidate. And so there's not a lot of knowledge about where John McCain and Ann Kirkpatrick stand on the issue. There's real room for the candidates to be defined to define themselves or define their opponents if they want on the issue. When you ask whether, for example, John McCain's position of voting for comprehensive immigration reform but opposing DACA and DAPA, does that make you more or less likely to vote for him this November? 46% say they are much less likely to vote for McCain, and 18% say they are somewhat less likely to vote for McCain. So even though he has voted for comprehensive immigration reform and has that reputation, his opposition to these very basic temporary measures, DACA and DAPA, are dragging him down.
That's Lynn Tremonti, Deputy Director of America's Voice. We've been talking about the organization's new poll with Latino decisions and how Latino registered voters view the Senate race between John McCain and Ann Kirkpatrick.
It's the show on 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And with John Hockenberry at The Takeaway, I'm Steve Goldstein. It's been 53 years since the Supreme Court ruled in Gideon versus Wainwright that everyone has a right to an attorney, even if they can't afford one.
That decision created the need for public defenders trained in criminal defense to represent defendants and to ensure they have a fair trial.
But the growing prison population and lack of funding for public defenders has led to overworked attorneys with limited resources and no relief, hence unequal justice. The Marshall Project, in partnership with The Guardian, is in the middle of a three-part series examining the consequences local jurisdictions face as they struggle to uphold the Constitution and provide legal defense for defendants as required under the Gideon v. Wainwright Supreme Court decision. Eli Hager is staff writer at The Marshall Project. His research took him down to the rural parishes of Louisiana. Eli, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
And Rhonda Covington is down there in those parishes, district defender in parishes in East and West Feliciana in the state of Louisiana. Rhonda, welcome to the show.
Hi, John. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
How much of a struggle is it to defend and deal with the caseloads that you are getting, and what are the consequences for defendants?
Well, it's a tremendous struggle for me as an attorney and as the district defender because I have to oversee all of the cases that come through. We have a growing caseload and not nearly enough resources in order to deal with the issues that we have. We need things like investigators, translators, attorneys, you know, just to name a few. And it has an impact on the people that we represent. I've got people who call me on a daily basis and want me to, why aren't you at the jail? Why aren't you meeting with me? Why aren't you helping me? And when, you know, I explain that I have got over 200 open felony cases, given the responsibilities that I have, I can't be there for all of them the way they want me to be.
Eli Hager, have you viewed that situation that Rhonda is describing broadly throughout the parishes you investigated?
I did see it broadly. Rhonda's situation is particularly extreme because she is the only full-time attorney there in her entire district, which handles over 900 cases. So she has a particularly extreme scenario. But in three or four of the other parishes I went to and in all of the parishes in Louisiana, they're having to put defendants on wait lists for a lawyer because they just had so many cases and not enough lawyers. So it's very common.
How are public defenders funded in the state of Louisiana?
So one of the unique things about the state of Louisiana is that they're funded primarily by traffic tickets at the local level. So there's a fee attached to traffic tickets and other court fees that goes to the public defender's office, but it's very unstable. So if the police aren't writing as many tickets or if there's a flood like there was recently and there aren't as many people in court and not as many tickets being written, their funding goes down the drain. They get a portion of their funding from the state, but that was also cut this year because of a huge budget crisis that Louisiana had. So it was kind of a 1-2 punch that public defenders around the state faced this year.
If they get the money from traffic tickets, is it the case that essentially the prosecutor's side of the equation controls the money for the public defenders on some level?
The district attorneys have the power to do a pretrial intervention. And they do that with the traffic tickets, which is our bread and butter. So what they'll do is to send a letter to the people with the tickets and say, hey, if you want this kept off your record, pay the fines and do this or do that. But you pay the fines directly to the district attorney's office and they get 100% of those fees and we get nothing. So basically, the DA's offices around the state are able to control how much money each district receives.
Rhonda Covington is something of a one-woman show in the 20th District, which covers two parishes in Louisiana. As Eli Hager said, over 900 cases. You have to do all the office work, the mail, everything. You're the sole attorney there, and you still do individual pleas. Eli, describe the mass pleas that you observed.
Right. So in the 16th District, which is a little ways away from where Rhonda works, I witnessed mass pleas. So this is a hearing in which 30 or even 50 people are kind of pleading to felony cases all together. So they're convicted and they're sentenced all at once in a hearing that lasts only a few hours. And
these are all different crimes.
These are all different crimes, and these are all serious crimes. So some people were being sent on the spot to prison for 10 or 15 years. And they're read their rights all together. So the judge will say, do you understand your right to a jury trial? And then the whole group of them will say, yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir. Do you understand your right to counsel? Yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir. So it's kind of this mass processing that happens. And it's partly because it's something that's happened in that district and some other districts for a long time, but it's been exacerbated by the overload that the public defenders are feeling and the fact that they can't give more individual attention to each of those cases.
Demographically, who are these defendants? What do they look like?
Almost entirely Black. They're all indigent because these are all cases that the public defender is handling. But they were mostly Black. So you see this eerie scene in the courtroom of defenders and prosecutors and the judge all being white, and they're kind of facing this panel of mostly Black defendants who are all in chains at the ankles, at the waist, and at the wrist. They have not been convicted yet, but they're all pleading together to crimes and will about to be sent to prison together.
Rhonda, where does the satisfaction come in your job? And tell me about a victory or two.
Well, the satisfaction comes from helping the people who need help, regardless of their situation, whether or not they're homeless or drug addicted. If we can get them into a program, that's a wonderful thing. And we've done that. I mean, I had a guy who was a Vietnam veteran who had gotten addicted to drugs while in Vietnam, and he was in his 60s and was caught with drugs for the very first time. And we got him into a rehab through the VA, and in which he stayed for over a year. And he came out of there a whole new man. And that was a wonderful victory there, just seeing the change in his life. There are a lot of people who are accused of crimes, and sometimes it's with little more than just a rumor. And I think that if the public really realized what was going on, that they would be afraid. They would be very afraid.
Rhonda Covington is district defender in parishes in East and West Feliciana in the state of Louisiana. Rhonda, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
And Eli Hager is a staff writer at the Marshall Project. His research took him to Louisiana as part of a three-part series that the Marshall Project is doing with The Guardian on the situation of public defenders in the United States. Eli, thanks to you.
Thanks for having me.
That's John Hockenberry at The Takeaway.
If you have to go to the hospital, you want to be treated for what brought you there in the first place and then leave. But the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention report, more than 720,000 patients ended up with a hospital-acquired infection in 2011. Researchers at the Translational Genomics Research Center, or TGen, have developed a test for detecting one HAI. With me to explain is Jolene Bowers, a postdoctoral fellow in TGen's Pathogen Genomics Division in Flagstaff. And Jolene, how exactly does your test work?
Well, what we've done is develop a test that's harnessing the power of genome sequencing. So what we can do is take samples from patients and actually screen them to see if they're at risk for getting an HAI. So in this way, we're hoping to catch infections or even outbreaks before they even happen.
So are you looking to see if patients are at risk or if they actually have it already?
Well, that's a good question. So what studies are showing is that patients are actually colonized with these organisms before they get infected. And what that means is they'll actually be carrying this around. So, for example, Klebsiella pneumoniae, that's the organism that we're focusing on. A lot of people will carry this around in their guts. And in the hospital, you know, for someone to carry around a Klebsiella pneumoniae in their gut is actually risky, because then that's when they might infect themselves with that same organism.
So how do you do this? Is it a blood test? Is it like a mouth swab?
Actually, the best sample type for this kind of test is actually a rectal swab, because, you know, Klebsiella pneumoniae is carried in the gut.
What led you to look for this particular organism to see? I mean, because there are a lot of different types of things that patients can pick up in hospitals, right?
Right, yeah. Klebsiella pneumoniae is one of several different species of bacteria that have really set up shop in hospitals and other healthcare institutions, especially like long-term care facilities. But Klebsiella pneumoniae in particular, there's some strains of this species that have been sweeping across the globe in healthcare institutions that are particularly antibiotic resistant and wreaking havoc.
So this tool that you're calling KlebSeq, does it have potential applications for other infections? Could you tweak it in some way maybe to make it able to test for other hospital-acquired infections as well?
Absolutely. So we call it KlebSeq, short for Klebsiella pneumoniae sequencing. But absolutely, we're actually working now to alter the test to be able to add in these other organisms that are particularly in hospital environments or in the healthcare environment.
Cost-wise, what are we looking at as far as being able to deploy this at some kind of scale?
Well, it is high throughput, so we're designing it to be able to handle, you know, hundreds of samples simultaneously, and that is what keeps costs down right now. But as technology advances, you know, hopefully we can switch to a more on-demand type thing. But right now, you know, on a per sample basis, it's probably, you know, between $15 and $30 to run a single sample. But I will point out that that is much cheaper than the cost of a hospital-acquired infection.
What has to happen for this to really get into hospitals and to really start making a significant dent in these hospital-acquired infections?
Well, yeah, we're on the research side of things. So we've developed this test and we've put it out there to the public. And what we're hoping is that we can work with a commercial company or a commercial lab to pick this up and really take it the next step to polish it up and maybe even get it through FDA approval.
Jolene Bowers is a postdoctoral fellow in TGen's Pathogen Genomics Division in Flagstaff. Jolene, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
It's probably fair to say you never know what you might find at a landfill. But in the case of one of Phoenix's, you'll find art and artists using recyclables to create that art. It's part of an artist-in-residence program at the city's 27th Avenue Transfer Station. And early next year, the art coming out of the pilot program will be on display. Rebecca Bloom-Rothman is the public art project manager in Phoenix's Office of Arts and Culture. And Rebecca, so you basically have two artists at a landfill.
Correct. We're partnered with the Public Works Department, so we really wanted to help them with Reimagine Phoenix and doing educational programming, and we designed an artist-in-residence program. So there are two artists, Ann Morton and Chris Lee, who are working with our office and working with the staff and the facility to collect materials and make artwork.
So they're basically taking trash recyclables and turning it into art.
Correct. Both Anne and Chris have a very different way of approaching it, but they're looking at what we throw away and carving out that material to make something new out of it.
Now, the idea of doing that, of taking basically other people's trash and turning it into art, is not a new concept necessarily. There are artists who do that all over the place. Is there something unique about this project that sort of separates it from what other folks are doing?
What makes this project, what makes this project really unique is that it's a much deeper look at the material itself. So for example, Chris Lee is looking at children's play sets, the big plastic pieces, and looking at those pieces as almost architecturally modular objects that can be built into other forms and used in different ways. Then Ann Morton is looking at the social side. What a lot of people don't know is that when we put something in the blue bin and it goes to the facility, there are people there who sort our trash. There are people who drive these trucks. And so Ann started to look at what happens after the trash and after the recycling leaves our homes. She's looking at the whole system.
Do the artists have any particular mission or charge from the city to look at an aspect of recyclables and trash in this way, or to examine X about the city and what its residents use and throw away?
Yes, the Artists in Residence program was set up so that the artists had to go through a pretty lengthy research period with the Public Works Department and with the folks that work out at the facility to look not just at the materials and how what ends up in the landfill and what ends up in recycling, but also what happens to it after it gets to the facility. Does it get recycled? If it doesn't get recycled, why not? So the artists are digging deeper to help carry that educational message.
I would imagine in some cases they are literally digging deeper, right, into piles of stuff to find things, right?
In fact, they are, yes. They are wearing hard hats and closed-toed shoes and safety vests and you name it.
Not a typical art studio.
Not at all.
So what kinds of things have they come up with so far?
Well, so far, again, Chris Lee has really been looking at what we call the diversion area, which is where big things go, things like your old refrigerator, things like your tires. And what she's found is that a lot of those plastic little tykes style play sets, when they crack and your children can't play on them anymore, there's only one place they can go. But what she's found is that they're really beautifully colored and that they're interesting shapes that can be fit together to make other possible materials. Ann Morton has found that when you look at an aluminum can and you toss it, it's just an aluminum can. But when you really look at the color and the material itself, it's quite a beautiful and interesting object, and it can be cut down and used to be made other objects.
Is there a part of this project, or maybe a large part of this project, that ultimately aims to get Phoenicians to think differently about what they put in their recycling bins?
Yes. Public Works has a program called Reimagine Phoenix. The goal of Reimagine Phoenix is to divert our waste from the landfill by 40% in 2020. Currently, the city is diverting 20%, which is up from about 5 years ago. But in working with Public Works, we're looking at different ways we can manage trash, and art is just one of the many ways.
Rebecca Bloom-Rothman is Public Art Project Manager at the Phoenix Office of Arts and Culture. Rebecca, thanks.
Thank you, Mark.
In a look at international news at 2:36, it's a concept based on getting to see the world while trying to make it a better place through voluntary work. Volunteer tourism has become one of the fastest growing trends in travel, with an estimated 1.6 million travelers worldwide.
Many of those go to Africa, but recent news has revealed why this help from abroad is being seen by some as more of a hindrance. The BBC's Nancy Kachungira reports.
Welcome back to Who Wants to Be a Volunteer, the show that's putting you on the front lines. I'm here with Lily, who's all the way from Europe, and she's one question away from winning the grand prize, a chance to save Africa.
That's one of many parodies you can find online, critiquing the self-serving side of voluntourism in Africa. From white savior Barbie to humanitarians of Tinder, several social media accounts have been set up with the intent of showing that some volunteers are more interested in cool profile pictures, sightseeing, and some work experience than in actually helping. That's the sound of lye and oils being vigorously mixed in a bucket to make soap. I'm at a school for children with special needs just outside Kenya's capital, Nairobi. Here I meet a 20-year-old British volunteer who's helping the kids make the soap, one of the vocational skills she helps to teach here. I asked Tamsin Selby why she chose to travel in order to volunteer.
I understand that there's a need in the UK, as in we have our own problems. However, you can understand that somewhere like Kenya and Africa in general has a much bigger problem.
The charity that arranged Tamsin's visit is anxious that some organizations that charge for placements are giving the whole industry a bad name. With travelers paying between $3,000 and $15,000 each, helping local communities may not be their first priority. George Awala is the country director of voluntary service overseas, Kenya.
Yeah, there are organizations that are exploiting volunteering and having what's called voluntourism. It is important that development organizations respect the local communities, work with them in an equal way, ensuring that even the beneficiaries or children who are supported are respected and are also given an opportunity to say what they want.
White plastic chairs are being arranged into a semicircle for a small meeting. The meeting's being chaired by Stephen Uchembe, the founder of the Kenya Society of Care Leavers. Raised in an orphanage, he believes that the system of receiving help from abroad creates a money-making industry that thrives at the expense of those who are most vulnerable.
We are props, you know, when it comes to that as children. You know, we used to also to sing for them, also dance and all that. The able-bodied children were used to be locked up in the dormitory, and our donors actually want something appealing.
The orphanage also made the children take off their shoes to appear more needy to visitors and write fake letters asking for money from donors. Stephen set up the Association of Care Leavers to give a voice and a safe space to others like him who felt used and powerless for so long.
Nobody asked me anything that I wanted or, you know, or what kind of people I needed to interact with, which is quite different from a normal household.
The motives of those who travel to Africa to volunteer have been widely debated, but it is the overall effect of this billion-dollar industry on local communities and people like Stephen that is of greater concern.
That's the BBC's Nancy Kachungira in Kenya.
It's alive!
You probably recognize that as one of the most iconic scenes of the classic movie Frankenstein. This summer is the 200th anniversary of Mary Shelley's idea that eventually became the novel. Now a new exhibit at ASU's Hayden Library is examining the history and cultural impact of the book, as well as how it relates to today and what our modern-day monsters are. KJZZ's Sarah Ventry spoke with Bob Beard of ASU's Center for Science and the Imagination about this.
Yeah, it turns out there's a lot to unpack. And when you really get at its core, Frankenstein is about so much more than just the one monster story we all think of. There were also a lot of things happening in the world at the time that led to its creation.
Mary Shelley imagined the idea that became Frankenstein actually 200 years ago, earlier this summer, June 16th, 1816. And it was this time of environmental crisis and social upheaval and amongst the Industrial Revolution. And it spawned this amazing story. And some say it was the very first science fiction story. And these themes really continue to resonate today, even 200 years later. And so this exhibit at ASU Libraries is looking at Frankenstein and its history and also its cultural impact today.
So that environment, that sort of Industrial Revolution, the sort of technological advances that were happening at the time, how did that impact Mary Shelley? How did it impact the novel?
So the summer of 1816 was called the Year Without a Summer. The year prior, there was an explosion. There was a volcanic explosion in Indonesia, and it was Mount Tambora. And it created this environmental crisis. There was this global darkening. This ash cloud surrounded the earth, and it led to famines. It led to crop die-off. It led to a refugee crisis. And so all of these things are present sort of in the novel. And Mary Shelley grew up in this time where there were public displays of science, where people were doing experiments with galvanism and actually shocking corpses and seeing if they could reanimate them. And so there's no surprise where some of these ideas came from, these themes of loneliness and man being able to control nature or having a desire to control nature. And that's really what's apparent in the final novel of Frankenstein.
So fast forward 200 years. One of the things that it sounds like this exhibit is trying to explore is sort of how are those factors shaping our world today?
I think what this exhibit really does is it looks at those conditions that inspired Mary Shelley and looks at our contemporary culture and explores these quandaries that we're experiencing right now in science and technology and, you know, our social existence in the modern era. And so there are themes from Mary Shelley's Frankenstein that are amazingly resonant today. You know, Mary Shelley was asking, what is the nature of life? And we're doing that right now. We're doing it with artificial intelligence. We do it in our library exhibit in sort of a playful way of asking if a social media hashtag could be considered a living organism. And it does meet several cases for life, maybe not all of them, but there's an argument to be made. So there's a lot of things that are happening in our modern era that are ripe for examination.
You know, you mentioned a minute ago that arguably Frankenstein is considered the first work of science fiction. Mm-hmm. When we think about science fiction today and where it's come, and when we think about sort of what the modern day equivalent of Frankenstein would be, or the modern day monsters that we're looking at in sort of the science fiction realm, what do you think those would be?
It's a great question. And really, I think it goes back to what are we afraid of? You know, Mary Shelley, at the time, she had a variety of social and technological and environmental anxieties that she might have been addressing in Frankenstein. And that's something that we're doing in our exhibit as well. We're asking people to sort of imagine a new monster for the 21st century. A lot of times people will take the Frankenstein story and they'll overlay it with the technology of today. So if you look at a film like Ex Machina, that's a Frankenstein story just about advanced robots. But I think what's interesting, going back to those anxieties, is what we might fear today. So is there a Frankenstein story to be told about body shaming? Is there a Frankenstein story to be told about GMOs? Is there a Frankenstein story to be told about gun control? I think any of these anxieties that we're experiencing right now could become a new sort of scary story for the 21st century.
That's Bob Beard of ASU's Center for Science and the Imagination.
And that's KJZZ's Sarah Ventry. Sarah, thanks.
Thank you.
It was January 15th, 2009, when a U.S. Airways jet carrying 155 passengers and crew made an emergency landing in New York's Hudson River. That flight and its aftermath are at the center of the new film, Sully.
And it happened 100 seconds after takeoff. We lost thrust in both engines. It was a life-changing event for everyone on the airplane.
Cactus 1549, runway 4, clear for takeoff.
Cactus 1549, clear for takeoff. I'll never get over how beautiful it is up here.
Life's easier in the air.
Chesley Sully Sullenberger was at the controls that day and responsible for landing the plane safely on the impromptu and very wet runway. His story is at the core of the new film. Michelle Moore was in the then Tempe-based U.S. Airways Corporate Communications Department and served as a consultant on the new movie. Michelle, what did it feel like as a U.S. Airways employee to know what was going on and to see that plane in the Hudson?
Well, January 15th, 2009 for me was the most terrifying day I have ever had on the job and ultimately the proudest day of my career. You know, the accident happened around 3:30 p.m. on a Thursday afternoon. It's one of those things you just never forget where you were when it happened. And I was at Charlotte Douglas International Airport in Charlotte, North Carolina, where I was based and where the plane was heading. Found out about it and immediately went into, you know, kind of activating our emergency plan, which for us meant you head up to the conference room and kind of start things going from there. Airlines have very, very well-developed emergency plans. And my role at the time, and still now, is as a company spokesperson, so managing our public response to it and communications to our employees.
Did it seem almost surreal?
It did seem surreal. And, you know, seeing the images of the plane floating down the river, you know, you thought, oh, I can't be seeing this correctly. And, of course, nobody was going to, or that you were going to have some fatalities in it at the very least. And then when it turned out to not be that way at all, and all 155 passengers and crew members survived, it was just an incredible thing. There just hasn't been anything like it.
What sort of questions do you ask a filmmaker or someone who's a producer or something like that who wants to talk with you about making it accurate? What sort of questions do you ask to make sure, yeah, we're on the same wavelength here?
Well, you know, first you just have a discussion, and with me it started, you know, we had heard, it wasn't a surprise, I don't think, to anybody that, you know, Sully's story, and the movie Sully is based on Captain Sullenberger's memoir, it was really no surprise that a story as amazing as this would, you know, get the Hollywood treatment. So we first got wind of it, I want to say, kind of towards the end of spring of 2015, and then we got a phone call from the production team, and that's how it started. And I met with them out in Charlotte. They were looking at some locations out there. So that's how I got started, and from that, just dove right in. They shared an advanced copy of the script with me and a couple of other folks, so we took a look at it to see if there was anything that, you know, stood out that was incredibly inaccurate or, you know, just not quite representative of the profession. And they were just really, really wonderful to work with on it and just committed to getting things right.
So how unique is Sully? How special was that? Is that something that we would expect a trained pilot to be able to pull off with a good crew?
What you had here was exceptional. You know, you had the right crew at the right time, at the right place, too. This happened in New York City, happened during the day. You had all of those first responders who were able to respond so quickly and save the lives of all 155 people on board. So it was just an extraordinary set of events, you know, that really came together to contribute to making it the Miracle on the Hudson. But Captain Sullenberger, just the right guy for the job.
Michelle Moore is Managing Director of Corporate Communications for American Airlines. She was a consultant on the new film Sully, which opened today.
The Tucson Police Department's Red Tag Unit is out in force around the city, including in neighborhoods around the University of Arizona. Its officers are enforcing Tucson's unruly gatherings ordinance. Violators face fines starting at $500. The ordinance has been in place for a few years, but this year, TPD is working with U of A police on a pilot program to increase law enforcement presence in certain neighborhoods near campus that tend to be more unruly than others. With me to talk about this is Detective Chris Goins with the Tucson Police Department. And Detective Goins, what's the goal here?
Its purpose is to minimize the number of unruly gatherings is what we're really focused on. Not trying to stop people from having birthday parties and things like that, but it's when the gathering gets unruly and causes other types of crime that spawn from that was its whole purpose.
And am I right that there have been some recent changes to either the ordinance itself or how the Tucson Police Department is going about enforcing it?
Well, the ordinance itself is still pretty much the same. The biggest thing that we've been looking at is really focusing our enforcement in areas that have, I guess you could say, are potential hotspots for this type of activity. So we looked at historical data and then came up with a plan on focusing our patrols in those specific areas. And that is spread throughout the entire city. So it's all throughout the north, south, east, and west of Tucson. We have areas where officers in each one of our divisions is specifically focused in trying to prevent a party from becoming an unruly gathering and stepping up our enforcement efforts in those areas.
Now, when you talk about unruly gatherings and trying to make sure that other problems don't sort of crop up from a party, how do you define that? I mean, at what point do you go in and say, okay, yes, these folks are violating this ordinance?
Well, when you have multiple vehicles blocking the road, for example, for you to be able to park, you have lots of trash strewn throughout yards and things like that. When the noise itself is just so loud that you can hear it from the street and people, both, you know, music as well as just voices carrying throughout the neighborhood, and then just disturbing the peace of your neighbors. All of those things kind of tie into. So it's not one single thing that we focus on, but it's just a conglomeration of multiple things, and that's when we say, okay, that is what equals an unruly gathering.
So we're talking about red tags, and it's my understanding that when officers respond to an unruly gathering, they actually physically put a red tag on a building. Is that right?
That is correct. There's a very bright red sticker that is placed on the door explaining the ordinance, what they were cited with, why they were cited, and the repercussions and how they can take care of this issue.
Is that in addition to or instead of coming into contact with the people who are inside?
That's in addition to.
So what's the benefit of having a sticker like that? I mean, it sounds from the outside kind of like a scarlet letter kind of thing.
It hate to make it sound that way, but it is a very visually unappealing symbol to have on the front of your door. And it does kind of bring awareness to the homeowner, the residents, and the neighborhood that this residence was cited for this type of violation, and if it happens again, then there are other repercussions as far as fines and other citations that the homeowner or the resident could receive.
Do you find that the tag is a deterrent?
Yes. Yes. We have definitely seen a decline. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but we definitely do see a decline in gatherings of an unruly nature in that neighborhood. That's not to say that people who have received this don't have another party, but then they at least now understand what happens when it gets out of control and how to keep it within the confines of the ordinance.
Detective Chris Goins with the Tucson Police Department. Detective Goins, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
This is the time of year when one of the most frequently asked questions is, are you ready for some football? Well, we're not going to be asking that, but we will be talking about the Arizona Cardinals, who start their season Sunday night with a nationally televised game against the New England Patriots. Sports Illustrated, by the way, is picking the Cards to win the Super Bowl, so, you know, no pressure or anything. With me for a preview of this season is Jess Root. He's the NFL site editor for Cards Wire. That's part of USA Today's NFL Wire. And Jess, let's get right to it. What are the expectations for the Cardinals this year?
Well, after a couple of successful years of kind of climbing a little bit, the mandate is kind of there. It's going to be a Super Bowl year, or it's going to be a big disappointment, and it's going to be a heartbreaking year. The team expects that, the coaches expect that, and the public is now kind of expecting it. The fans know, we know that they're good, that they are talented, and they have everyone back and have even improved in certain areas. So it's kind of there. It's there. They need to be a Super Bowl team or they're a disappointment.
It seems like this or something similar to this has been the expectation going into the last couple of seasons. What has to go right for the Cardinals? Because obviously they haven't won the Super Bowl. So what has to go right for them to actually achieve their goal?
Well, first and foremost, like with any key NFL team, there are key players that have to stay healthy. Carson Palmer is one of them. I think on the defensive side of the ball, Patrick Peterson is probably that guy, and probably Chandler Jones, one of the guys they brought in the offseason. And number two, I mean, they need to take care of business, so they need to win the games that they're supposed to do and not lose any that they shouldn't. That happens, tends to happen every year. And really, as we saw in last year's playoffs, the easiest road to the Super Bowl is to have the best record and to get home field advantage. Had they been able to play the Panthers at home last year, it would have been a completely different ballgame. And each of the last 2 years, being on the road in the playoffs has kind of been their bugaboo.
Do you get the sense that the players are motivated by not making it to the Super Bowl last year? Are they sort of weighed down by the expectations that, hey, this year they ought to make it to the Super Bowl?
I don't get that sense. They were very disappointed in how they played, and that's kind of fueling everything because they know they're good. One of these things that I kind of notice is that this group of players, they don't feel weighed down, but they're really excited because they are good. And so it's exciting to go to work because they know what this team could be. Since they haven't won it yet, there's not the, you know, it's not like I've heard someone talk about the Dallas Cowboys of the 90s. That first Super Bowl team was incredible fun. The second one wasn't so much because they'd already done it, so they had to do it again.
Given the fact that the Diamondbacks are having a disappointing season, the Coyotes have, and the Suns are kind of down right now, it seems like this has really, really become, even more so than it was, a Cardinals town. What kind of impact does that have on the players? I mean, do they care about that at all?
They do, and Larry Fitzgerald mentioned it the other day. He said, you know, 12 years ago, his first home game was against the Patriots, and he said he couldn't give away tickets. The ones now are going for $250 and more. It's exciting. People are they're recognized around town. They're no longer the laughingstock of the league, which, you know, during the 90s and the early 2000s, they were really seen as a terribly run organization. They were a joke in the NFL. The closest I can come to, in my experience, having lived here basically my entire life, is the 1992-93 Suns, when after they got Charles Barkley and had the new arena, that season was all Suns, and it was a buzz. And Phoenix has always kind of been a football town, just not Cardinals town. But it is officially, the Cardinals own the fans here because, well, one, it's football, and this area loves football. And two, there's no other team to grab hold of yet.
Jess Root is the NFL site editor for Cards Wire, which is part of USA Today's NFL Wire, talking about the Cardinals season, which kicks off on Sunday night against the Patriots. Jess, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.